Hey, Zach, how you doing today?
Ken, I'm doing flipping fantastic, man. How are you?
It's been a long day, Zach. But it's good. I'm glad we can make time to talk to you. We're recording a couple days later than we normally do due to some like travel and work things. But I'm glad we were able to fit it in.
Yeah, I am too. This is actually a pretty exciting subject, which, Ken, what is it we are talking about today?
We're going to talk about mobile device security, which is particularly auspicious as today is iPhone 8 day.
Ooh.
So, I happen to have a new iPhone 8 Plus, and so, we wanted to address a little bit of what it means to be secure in this increasingly mobile world, and I figured we'd use this as a platform. So first, I need to apologize. I sound a little bit like Macy Gray here, but I was in Chicago this week, and I got sick, so go me.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Ken. You probably caught a virus.
Yeah, no, it was something like that. No, seriously, I was in this conference center for 3 days, and it was literally the coldest room I've ever been in my entire life. And I'm not a guy who gets cold, right?
Mm-mm, nope.
I have plenty of masks to keep myself warm, but... like this thing that you could have hung beef in there, like it was cold. So and I think that had something to do with it, not to mention lots of things. So so first a couple items of follow-up, and so these are sort of interesting follow-up items, but we wanted to address them. We've explored some of these topics in earlier shows. So the first one is one of the my favorite titles of all time. This is from TheVerge.com, article dated September 21, 2017.
Oh, boy.
The title is, "The Invention of AI Gaydar Could Be the Start of Something Much Worse." So this is, we talked about AI, and we talked about, how creepy some of this, computational processing of our data, and how... we're not exactly sure what companies like Google and Facebook actually do with our data when we send to it to. And, the question often becomes, well, what's the worst they can do? Well, here's one thing. And so, and I don't know if this is true. I think we need to hold this with take this with a grain of salt and realize that, these are just people going for fame and whatever. But, there's researchers now who claim that they can spot, gay people from a photo. Right, so based upon the geometry of the face, they can train a model to determine whether or not somebody's straight or gay just by looking at them.
Are you kidding? Right. This is like back in the early 20th century where a person's face could determine if they were like a serial killer or like a murderer. Remember that?
I mean, there was that science. They used to have the science of they'd feel like the shape of your heads, the bumps on your head and stuff.
Yeah.
And supposedly that would dictate, certain things. I don't know if this is true. The one thing I will say about neural, various forms of machine learning is that we don't really understand the mechanics by which they work.
I guess, because this is kind of beyond my understanding. I don't know. I'm a film major, so maybe everything's beyond my grasp.
Well, so the article states that, and I'll read this, given a single facial image, the software could correctly distinguish between gay and heterosexual men in 81% of cases and in 71% of cases for women. These rates increase when the system is given 5 pictures of an individual, up to 91% for men and 83% for women.
How? I don't understand. What if you take a picture of, Richard Simmons' face and it determines yes, even though he's always, then again, that's not a good example, but you get my point. I don't get how you could tell just by a face. Does it explain any further?
There are some issues with this. So let's just start here. So first, this is trained on a data set of pictures that are taken from a dating website, right? And so it makes it very easy to distinguish between, homosexuals and heterosexuals, right? So if you're a guy looking for another guy, it assumes you're gay. If you're looking for a woman, it assumes you're straight, right? And so I think one issue is gender is far more fluid than that. So that's a huge issue, too. It's not nearly as binary as this research shows. The second one is, I think there's some selection bias here. People who show up on a website, they probably take similar kind of photos. They're probably trained by the website to choose different kinds of photos. The commonalities between, there may exist bias in the data that trends towards, you know, one sexual orientation versus the other. So I guess what I mean to say is, like, I'm not sure this is universal. These results are limited to one, to one data source, as far as I know. And then the third thing is, we don't know how good these people are, right? Do they actually test their model on random data, testing data that hadn't been trained on? Like we don't know any of the mechanics here. So aside from, like, whether or not this is actually true, and, like, there is a way to determine sexual orientation just from, like, a machine learning algorithm on a face, which I, quite frankly, highly doubt. What's concerning is the fact that this research suggests that you can. And so these algorithms can be used for purposes that may not be necessarily in the best interests of humanity. And so this is like one of the first examples I've seen of machine learning really being used for evil things. And so, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why people would want to keep their sexual orientation private. You know, hiring, housing, being like a couple of them. There's places in the world where, you know, homosexuality is still a crime.
Yep.
That's another important reason. Then the fourth is just human privacy, right? And it should be up to the person's choice, you know, how their sexual orientation is presented or revealed. And you certainly don't need some algorithm making judgments based upon that. So this is a classic example of a technology that goes too far, right? And no technology is inherently evil. It's always the use and application that produces the evil intent, but this is a great example. Now, these researchers, they're just trying to write a paper. You know, they're not trying to, you know, do anything more than that, as far as I know. But it's an interesting point there. So, yeah, AI, it's here, and I don't think it's going anywhere, and we're going to see more of this stuff, not less.
This is what Elon Musk predicted, Ken, to the wire.
Yep. Elon Musk is there.
All hail.
Yes. Okay. So, second piece of news I want to talk about, and this is follow-up on the Equifax disaster. I think we had an update last week as well. Like, this keeps getting worse and worse. So we know that, you know, Equifax, the credit card bureau, or the credit bureau, they had a huge breach, 143 million user details.
Which is
social security numbers.
Which is just so lovely. Some
addresses. Yeah, I mean, it's like one of the biggest breaches ever. Now, in the grand scheme of things, like, this, I don't actually think this is all that big of a deal. It's more it's more alarming that it continues to be symptomatic of a larger problem. And that is, you know, how we treat data and the fact that these agencies can exist in the first place. Like, I've never done business with Equifax, but yet they have my information, can adversely affect me. So that's a bigger issue. They identified the root cause of this issue. It was a vulnerability in what's called Apache Struct, or Struts, rather. I apologize. So there was a patch that was released on March 8th. And that was later exploited in July. It was never fully patched. One of the issues with these Apache Struts vulnerabilities is the application basically has to be rebuilt after the patch is applied. And so it's not like, you know, just updating your computer. There's a little bit more of an involved process there. Equifax claims that this isn't like necessarily the root cause of the issue, but it pretty much appears to be the truth. Looks like they held this information for a long amount of time before they ultimately released it. During this time, three senior executives sold $1.8 million of Equifax shares.
Whoa.
There's a lot of like shady stuff. And then a lot of these Equifax security folks have ultimately retired following the hack. And that's like my biggest issue, right? Like there's zero accountability. And like the law doesn't really allow us to hold these people accountable. Now, I'm a security guy, right? And I don't really want to be, you know, nailed to the wall either. But we have we should have some skin in the game. You know, Sarbanes-Oxley, the big accounting law that was rolled out in the wake of these big financial scandals such as Enron, that holds certain individuals, primarily the CEO and CFO, personally responsible for the integrity of the information that's presented to their shareholders. I think there needs to be something with IT security as well. The chief of the OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, the government agency that was breached in what I contest is the most damaging breach in history, she just resigned afterwards. And these people are very well paid. They just walk out, and all of a sudden they're free and clear, and that is wrong. And so that's Ken's soapbox office soapbox today. We need to hold these people accountable and expect results from these individuals.
Exactly. That's such a good point too. I think I remember you saying that you were kind of struggling with the same thing at your current place, but nah, that doesn't really apply here. I will say that it did used to apply at the job I currently work. There was a previous guy who ran the company, and at one point they had some ridiculous number of people on payroll. It was some just insane amount. It was like there was like 104 people on payroll, and right now there's only like what, 6 employees? It's
Wow.
It wasn't like they were paying them all full salary, but there were that many people getting paid some menial amount, and it all added up pretty quick. And I don't mean to go down this rabbit hole, but essentially after he got fired, my new boss got on board and had to clean it up for months. He didn't take salaries forever. I mean, you get the point. You know, it's just no accountability.
Yeah. Well, personal responsibility is pretty rare these days.
Yep.
And we need to start with these individuals who had a, who are ultimately responsible for the results. And so, we are all vulnerable. None of us are immune, but we need to take the necessary steps. And when we don't, we need to take accountability for those actions. So that's a broader narrative on like society as a whole, how we tend to like shirk our responsibilities as individuals. But, particularly in these instances that affect, like, that many people. I mean, 143 million people.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
Like, there should be a perp walk, right? Somebody should be, like, handcuffed and, like, you know, shoved into a squad car.
Wait. Well, what about that shame scene from Game of Thrones? The Cersei walk?
I've never seen Game of Thrones.
Who can you are missing out? To people who understand what I'm saying, you'll know.
It's on my to-do list.
Okay. But sorry, yes, thrown in a squad car. Just, yeah, absolutely.
It's on my Plex server, Zach. I just got to make the time.
Oh, that's right. Let me log into that real quick.
Too busy making podcasts. Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, today we're going to talk about some mobile device security measures. This isn't going to be an exhaustive list, but we just want to talk about some of the factors that we consider when we start talking about securing our mobile devices. And some of this might be controversial. That's fine, you know, whatever. Chad doesn't care, so it's all good. So when we can start talking about mobile device, it's basically anything, you know. I think we're going to limit it to something like a smartphone or a tablet. I guess you could consider a laptop a mobile device. That's a little bit outside the scope of this show. So, you know, just think like a device that runs iOS or Android or, you know, BlackBerry or Windows Phone if you're a masochist. That'll sort of be where we define the scope for this episode. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is this concept, and we've addressed it before when it comes to, like, personal computers, but it's the fact that software is a liability. So anytime you install a piece of software on your machine, you incur a little bit of risk. And even with, you might incur some risk to solve another problem. So you might install antivirus software on your PC to protect yourself against the risk of a virus or malware entering your system. But at the same time, you're installing software that, you know, you rely upon people, fallible human beings, to maintain and to keep free from vulnerabilities, and that's not always the case. So anytime you install software on your machine, it opens you up to risk. Now, that risk may be worth it, or it may not be. That's ultimately up to you. So my first piece of advice when it comes to a mobile device is to install the bare minimum software that is required for your task. So, you know, I see these people with phones and they have, you know, 400 apps installed. And that, like that, now I'm a little OCD, and so I have one home screen, and that is it, because that's how I roll. But one of the features of that is it makes it very easy for me to know what is on my phone. It makes it very easy for me to ensure it's kept up to date, and it makes and limits my risk. Now, I'm in the iOS ecosystem. I have a little less, due to some of the sandboxing restrictions, I'm a little less vulnerable to the software vulnerabilities opening doors to other things than on some platforms, but it's still a valid concern. So your software that you install on your phone should be vetted. It should be understood what it's doing. It should be understood what you should understand what it has access to. And then it should be constantly reviewed to see if it's still applicable, if it's still updated, and if you still need it. And if you don't, take it off.
What if it's Tetris, and I just don't play it anymore, Ken. Like, I don't play it anymore. What's the harm in leaving Tetris on my phone?
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is, Tetris is probably fine, right? It's more of a general thing. Like, if there's functionality on your phone that you're not using, remove it. If you decide to add it later and you make that value judgment again, okay, this is worth the risk, this is worth the space, this is worth the battery and the CPU cycles that it takes to run the background, if that's applicable, then, you know, install it again. But at least make that conscious decision. Like, so much we talk about security versus convenience, right? And so, you know, just make that choice. Worst thing you can do is just leave it static because it's always been on there and, like, whatever, and never think about it, right? If we can get you to think about things, then we win, right?
I suppose that's a good point.
So this is more applicable when it comes to like a PC, in my opinion, but on mobile devices, it's 100% applicable as well. So second thing we talked about is passphrases. So passphrases are sort of an interesting topic. You see it a lot brought up in the news. So certain types of phones cannot be accessed without the passphrase. Those most famously came to light in the San Bernardino terrorist investigation, where Apple refused to unlock the individual's work iPhone, and they were forced to pay like $1 million to some Israeli firm to surreptitiously gain access. So a lot of these devices, you're not able to gain access to them without the passcode. The truth of the matter is, if you choose a 4-digit PIN, you know, like 1234 is your passcode, you might as well just, you know, not use it at all. It's a protection against, like, your kid, maybe. It's a protection against a dumb to medium-skilled criminal. But anything past that, it can be pretty easily circumvented. There's software and hardware that you can buy off the shelf, shipped to your door right now, that can bypass 4-character PIN on mobile devices.
Really, it's that easy?
It is that easy.
I do remember seeing a video where you could actually do this little hack where if you upgrade or downgrade the firmware of your phone and it goes through the kind of the setup menu, right, with the white background, it'll ask you for your passcode at one point. And the thing is, you can try it an unlimited amount of time, so it won't ever lock you out because, you know, you're just setting it up. But obviously, it's still retaining some of your old settings. It still retains your old data. You're just updating the firmware. And there's some like devices you can buy that just constantly try every combination possible until it, you know, brute forces its way in. So I could see that being the case. But I mean, geez.
So there's a couple issues there. I mean, there's actually devices that you can buy, and it forces, like, in some instances, it requires you to disassemble the phone. But what it'll actually do is it'll have some mechanism for typing in these codes. And then it has a means, and you ultimately bypass the power to the phone with a custom power supply. And so what it can do is it will boot, you will enter a code, and then it will cut power if it's not right. And so by cutting the power to it and restarting that whole cycle, you bypass. A lot of these phones have countermeasures in it that say, you know, after 10 or, you know, 5 or 10 wrong passcodes, like lock the device, or, you know, you can actually have it delete your content or whatever. And so there's means to even circumvent that. So my recommendation is to at least go to a 6-character passcode. If you're going to use numeric passcodes, you know, that takes you from 1,000 to what, 100,000?
Yeah.
Or 10,000 to, yeah, sorry, 10,000.
Well, I'm actually just under 1 million, right?
Yeah, 1 million. Right, yeah, 1 million. And so that drastically, I mean, it's an order of magnitude, a couple of orders of magnitude better protection there.
Yeah, and it's like now, two more numbers to remember. Come on.
Right. You know, now the other thing is you got to remember, just like a password, it has to be something that can't be guessed, so it probably shouldn't be, you know, month, day, and year of your birthday. That would be pretty easy. So, you know, just think about some random pattern. Probably shouldn't be common patterns either. So a lot of people, you know, they'll make a star or an X on their phone. You're not probably not fooling anyone. So
you know what I found? You know what I found actually is sometimes acts as a good passcode. And this is like a good tip. It's sort of a good tip to whoever's listening. Whatever code you use for your garage door, it's a number you remember, and it's not likely that anyone's going to be able to figure out that that is what your passcode is, or even find out what it is.
Sure.
It actually works pretty well.
Yeah, no, I think that's... No, I mean, anything like that that allows you to increase the complexity of your password, but you still remember it, I think is a valid thing. Now, be careful. You don't want to reuse passwords, but yeah, I think that's, you know, there's certain tools that you can use depending on your circumstance to increase the complexity and still be able to remember it. The best possible, my ultimate recommendation is that you choose an alphanumeric passcode for your phone. You actually come up with a secure password that you remember that you can enter into your phone. That's what I do. My password is over 12 characters long, has letters, numbers, special characters, and mixed cases. Is it a pain to type in? You bet. So that's that whole security versus convenience trade-off again. I tend to be on more on the security side of that balance. But, you know, with these modern features such as Touch ID, or some of the other, you know, biometrics, it makes it a lot easier. So that's my recommendation. You know, pick out your optimal solution based upon your risk threshold, and you know, put it in place. So today I got my iPhone 8 Plus. It's a great phone. I looked at getting the iPhone X, but it's actually like a smaller phone. I like the 8. I like the plus form factor, and so I wasn't ready to go to that. Maybe when they come out with an X Plus or whatever next year's bigger bezel-less phone is, maybe I'll pick that up. So this phone has Touch ID rather than Face ID, and so I thought it'd be good to talk briefly about biometrics and various, and some of my thoughts there. So Apple quotes that Touch ID is a 1 in 50,000, you basically have a 1 in 50,000 chance of somebody else, not being you, gaining access to your phone based upon a fingerprint that's saved in Touch ID. What they don't tell you is that that's based upon you only having one fingerprint saved in your phone, right? So your right thumb or your right index finger or whatever you want to use. You pick one, you use it, you get a 1 in 50,000 chance of other people using it. As soon as you start adding fingers, right? So maybe you want your index finger. Maybe you want your left thumb. The chances of somebody else being able to access your phone goes up significantly. Now, is it to a point which like it's a possible attack vector, I would still say no. There's some issues with Touch ID, largely that, like, it's maybe easier for legal authorities to compel you to give access to your finger, right? If you get arrested, they can, you know, get you finger, they can take your fingerprints by law, you know, they can force you to do that. But they, you know, in most countries, at least in the United States, at least, they can't beat a passphrase out of you yet. Anyway, that may come to pass. You know, certainly you want to use Touch ID. The latest iPhone has a feature where you can tap the home button a couple times and it will actually lock Touch ID and force you to put in the passcode. So, you know, if the man's hard in your tail, yeah, that's something you could do.
That's neat.
So, iPhone X, they did away with Touch ID. It's a pretty controversial move for the cycle. They did replace it with Face ID. Face ID is, it's not a new feature. Now, maybe it's typically what Apple does. Typically, they take functionality that's been out there for a while, and they improve it, refine it, and present it in a better user experience. They may have done that, or may have not have. I don't know. excuse me. In this instance, you know, they claim that Face ID is one in a million, right? And you can only have one face tied to each phone. That may change in the future, but you have a one in a million shot of somebody else being able to access your phone. In the iPhone keynote, they famously called, there's an episode of Star Trek where you had an evil Spock and a good Spock, so evil Spock could probably get access to your phone, because they have the same facial structures. If you have an identical twin, that would probably defeat the purpose as well. But for the most part, your average person, Face ID, I think, is going to be a reasonable option, assuming it works the way they say it does. So one thing I think is kind of interesting is to ask yourself, why? Well, a lot of that has to do with the concept called entropy, right, or complexity. And so, you know, we talked a lot about if your passcode is four characters long and it's all numbers, then there's a finite number of options that can be. You can have 10,000 options, right, counting 000. If you increase that to an alphanumeric password that is, you know, 20 characters long, then the entropy involved in calculating all those various combinations and permutations of that character set is drastically increased. I mean, by orders and magnitude and a total number of combinations that, you know, our minds can't even fully appreciate. So you think about, like, you sticking your thumb on this Touch ID sensor. It's taking a diameter that's maybe, what, a centimeter. And it, you know, scans that and it applies it to a model that is stored and it sees there's a match. And there's, you know, your fingerprint isn't perfect every time. And so there's probably some amount of variability in that scan. And so the phone has to say, okay, that is close enough that within a high degree of confidence, this is actually Zach. With the Face ID, you know, they use some advanced technology. They actually project dots on your face. And they use a depth sensing camera to take a depth image of your face, determine how it's, like, contoured and, like, where various pieces are. And then it takes a picture and scans that against the model. So instead of just using, like, the tip of your thumb, it's using, like, your whole head or whatever is visible in the camera. So there's a lot more entropy, a lot more possibilities for it to gather data and confirm that with an existing model. So I think all in all, Face ID will be a better solution from security. It all comes down to implementation. We just don't know.
Yeah, I was about to say, what stops me from putting on a nicely detailed... I mean, they claim that, oh, even Hollywood mask experts weren't able to crack it, you know? I don't know. Guess we'll have to see.
Well, I mean, don't think that this isn't going to, you know, be tested, right? I mean, certainly will. And people, you know, if they can defeat it, it's going to be a huge black eye for Apple. And, you know, there is some, you know, Microsoft Surface devices, they have that Windows Hello feature. And to the best of my knowledge, I haven't done a lot of research on it, but to the best of my knowledge, that uses a similar depth mapping function and it works quite well and it can't be fooled easily. So, you know, I think we talked about this before. If you if you piss off a nation state with like advanced intelligence and, you know, surveillance technology, you're screwed anyway, right?
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, like if I was Edward Snowden, I probably wouldn't use Face ID.
Or Rocket Man.
Right. Yeah, Rocket Man. Yeah, that wouldn't be good either. But certain, you know, for your average individual, I think it's going to be sufficient. It's going to be improvement over Touch ID, hopefully. And I wouldn't worry about it. So maybe next year, they'll make me a big one, and I'll cough up the dough for that. So I want to talk briefly about like what's actually stored in your phone. And this goes back similar to our first point with software's liability. The data that you keep on your mobile devices, your tablets, your phones, your laptops, that's a vulnerability too. So yeah, we take steps to protect it. But the best source of protection, it's like they used to say in middle school, best form of birth control is abstinence, Zach. And so if we can abstain from having sensitive data on our mobile devices, then we begin to drastically reduce the issues if those devices were compromised, if our precautions, security measures were circumvented somehow. So, you know, maybe you don't need to keep the, you know, 11 secret herbs and spices on your iPhone, right? Maybe that's something that should be, you know, kept someplace else. Maybe all those nude photos you took of yourself in that lizard lounge, you know, just keep those locked away in an encrypted drive on your PC and not stored in your, you know, Dropbox on your mobile phone.
Well,
right?
Well, Ken, I do declare, how am I going to remember my 23 secret herbs and spices if I don't carry it with me?
Yeah, I mean, that's a valid point. You know, so again, like, it's security versus convenience, like our standard refrain. But, you know, something to think about, like, what do I actually need on here?
My 23...
Is there a place that makes sense?
23 lizards and amphibians.
Yeah, exactly. Right. There's a guy in the plane, and I'm pretty sure he had, like, a big snake in a cardboard box that he, like, carried on the plane. Like, it was like this box. It was huge. Maybe, like, 3 foot wide. 3 foot square, and then, like, maybe 1 foot, like, tall.
Okay.
And it had and it was, like, tied with rope and had a bunch of holes in it.
You have to ask if they had holes in it, but tied with rope. Okay.
And I was like, I was like, are we gonna have, like, a snakes on a plane incident right here? I mean, is that what this is?
Are you tired of these monkey fighting snakes on this Monday the Friday plane?
Yeah, exactly. Like, the Sam Jackson wasn't on there, Zach. Like, it wouldn't have been good.
All right, Ken, tell me more about data storage.
So, same thing goes for various cloud services. So, if you use a cloud service such as Dropbox or Box or, you know, iCloud Drive or something like that, does it really need to be on your phone? You know, just think through that process. Like, is that, if a malicious party gains access to your mobile device, does it actually need, is it worth it? Is the trade-off of you not having access to that data worth the additional security you get of keeping it safe? Again, it's this whole thing, right? It's up to you to judge. There's probably certain data that shouldn't be on your phone. There's probably certain data that shouldn't be in the cloud. And there's probably, you know, certain data you shouldn't put anywhere, right? So, yeah. You know, There's one thing that I have. One piece of information that I have, and this is going to sound super weird, but it's true. Like, I will never write down. I will never, like, speak of it. I will never put it online or in any way, shape, or fashion. It's something, like, that I hold, like, incredibly personal. And so, like, I certainly wouldn't put that in Dropbox. I certainly wouldn't put it on my mobile phone. The only place it exists, to the best of my knowledge, is in my head. And so, excuse me, if you have information that fits in that criteria, you know, don't put it on there.
There you go. Could be simpler than that.
Yeah. Password managers are another incredible valuable tool. So you should be using them on desktop. You should be using them on mobile, right? There's no exceptions there. They can be incredible, useful tools. You have your passwords everywhere you go. Password managers also have a great ability to store files securely. So I use 1Password. And so I have a certain amount of data that's encrypted in that 1Password file. And so even if someone were to able to gain access to my phone surreptitiously, they would have to bypass yet another layer of security. It's that hurdling or layering of defense that we've talked about before. Defense in depth, it's also called. And so, you know, that's just, you know, another option for you. VPNs, we did a whole show on them. Highly recommend that. VPNs just secure the connection between you and wherever you're going. VPNs are a tool that are used if you're worried about your information being hijacked or read or manipulated between you and you know, the source of your information, or you know, your connectivity source. So we talked about, we had a whole show on that. Go back and listen to that. VPNs are important. They should be used anytime you're on a sketchy network. Hardware attacks are an interesting one. So I used to teach a security class at my place of employment, and I always told the story. You know, don't ever plug anything into your PC. You don't know where it's been. You know, you walk in through the airport, you plug your phone into an outlet, into a random USB port. You have no idea, like, if that's sanitized. There could actually be something behind that port that, you know, gains access to your device. Certain mobile devices have features that will not allow the USB port to actually manipulate the data. So, like, if you plug an iPhone in, it'll say, do you trust this device or not? You can say no. There's also a cool device out there. It's called a USB condom.
Ooh.
And it's basically what it says. You just slip it on over your, you know, your USB-A plug and plug it into like a sketchy source. And it physically blocks all the pins except those for power.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, yeah, doesn't it just block some of those? So yeah, okay. How much are those, actually? I'm going to look that up real quick.
Well, so like, there's one company that makes them, and I tried buying some on Alibaba. But I think you can pick one up for like $8 or something, which is a lot for what it is. But if you traveled a lot and, you know, had a habit of plugging into sketchy places, you know, it'd be worth the investment.
Yep, there it is. It's $7 for the original. They've got a new one, which is like $13. It's fancier. Doesn't have exposed PCB boards. That's kind of neat.
These may get more common. It wouldn't surprise me if you could get like charge-only cables too, especially since now that you know, syncing over a computer is less important than it used to be.
Yeah.
So you know, hardware is always like the easiest way to gain access to a device. So you need to take physical security seriously too. Encryption. So a lot of devices, I mean, most devices are encrypted by default nowadays. If you start going into like lower end Android phones, that may or may not be true. But most of the flagship devices, and certainly all the Apple devices, they're encrypted by default. The degree of which and the quality of that decryption varies. This is going to be a controversial statement. I'll go ahead and say it. If you're really worried about security, I would argue you need to be on either an Android device that is designed for it, or you need to be on iOS.
So those cheap Android phones that it seems so appealing that are like, you know, $200, you know, flat, you know, those probably aren't good candidates for a secure device.
Yeah, I mean, from first glance, I would stay away from them. Now, maybe you know, maybe there is a, you know, the one of the great advantages of the Android ecosystem is you can make a phone with anything as a point of emphasis. And so maybe there's a cheap Android phone that's really secure, just limited functionality other ways or something like that. Or maybe there's a perfect phone that's only $200. I don't know. But at least look at that.
I got you.
With Android, you need to be a little bit more concerned. iOS comes pretty secure out of the box. So, you know, just make sure your phone's encrypted. If it goes against loss, if it gets lost, you're able to restrict access to it. Even remote wipe would be huge, too. The other piece I want to talk about is a lot of times people, we use mobile devices for work. For work, or we enroll them on corporate networks. A lot of times these mobile device management solutions, they're often referred to as MDMs. They require the installation of profiles onto your phone to access company resources. So from a network side, network security side, this makes a lot of sense. So I can force people to use a passphrase. I can force people to encrypt their phone. I can force people to, you know, have an auto timeout on their phone that locks the screen after 2 minutes of inactivity or whatever. I have all these features that I'm able to do. I can actually even remote wipe a phone. Funny story, like I used to work with this guy, and he ended up getting terminated for a lot of reasons. And we had a member of our IT team, and he was given an instruction to doing a selective wipe on this individual's phone. Basically just go in and delete anything that was related to the organization. He clicked the wrong button and nuked this guy's entire phone. I felt so bad for him. I'm glad it was him, not me. He got away with it. I probably wouldn't have.
Oh, dude.
So just know, like, if you install, and typically this is, like, clearly spelled out in, like, your simple use agreement, and it's also, like, you're informed when you install on your phone. Like, just know that, like, that corporation, like, your workplace, can do a lot of things with your device and not necessarily with your permission, you know? And so, you know, we may be in a situation where you have to, it's a BY, you know, bring your own device sort of environment. But just know, like, that company has a tremendous amount of power. And, you know, you're no longer in full control of that device. And then some of your precautions, various settings can be circumvented. excuse me, I'm losing my voice. I apologize. Podcasting is not fun when you're sick.
Yeah, I'll have to usurp you and start taking over control of these, Ken.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about lizards. Talk about the Persec lizard
show. Yeah. No, it's good. One last thing I want to talk about, and this might be controversial as well. It's like what to do if you're in a rough situation and you need to lock down your device immediately. And the two points I want to talk about is like the situation where like you're, you know, under the scrutiny of a police officer or, you know, fairly or unfairly or whatever, or, you know, you're crossing an international border where some of your rights can and, you know, in some cases will be, you know, challenged. If you have a device that's encrypted, you know, they can't necessarily compel you to enter the password. There's a process for doing that. What they can do is they can hinder you. You know, they can stop you from leaving. They can detain you, you know, if it's a like a police situation, or they can actually, you know, keep you from entering the country if it's a border situation. Typically in the long run, as long as you play it cool and you don't do anything in a flame situation, the law is on your side. You know, typically those will be worked out in your favor. They may not be in the short run by any means. So there are a couple things you can do. You know, certain devices have a way of locking them down to where biometrics don't work, to where you can't be compelled to do that. So we talked about the iPhone. If you tap the wake button a few times, it will disable Touch ID. There's probably various ways of doing that on various Android devices as well. It's going to vary depending on the device. When you're traveling across international borders, that gets a little more interesting. You know, they may deny you entry until you give them access to your devices, and in some instances, your social media passwords.
Wait, really? Your social media passwords?
That's one of the newer tools they'll use. They'll go on your Facebook and see if you, you know, befriended jihadis or something.
Oh, jeez. That's good to know, I guess.
So one tool I really like, so I use 1Password. I talk about it a lot. Other services have similar functionalities. Is they have a what they call a travel mode. And so what this travel mode does, it allows you to selectively sync certain amounts of your information. And so if I go into 1Password, in my control panel there, I'm able to specify which logins I want to be accessible to outside of the, or when it's in travel mode, and which ones I don't. And so there's possibilities that I can actually set up, prevent some of this in beforehand. If I know I'm going to be crossing the border, I can, you know, turn off access to some of this. And so, like, if they say, hey, you don't give me access to your Facebook, I can legitimately say, I have no ability to give you access to that. Right. It gives you some plausible deniability there. And also, you know, if you have certain documents that are sensitive or whatever, and you keep them inside your password manager vault, there's a means to, like, disable that. So they're not even on your phone. And it greatly reduces your, you know, the chance of an issue. I used to work for a company that did a lot of international travel. One of the things we did there is we provided loaner devices. They're just wiped, like, basic installations. At that time, we were all Gmail suite anyway. And so everything pretty much was accessible via online, gave them access to a VPN so they could technically get onto our network and access file shares or whatever. And so when these people cross international borders, if they so choose, they could grab one of these sterile laptops and, like, whatever happened to it, whatever. And we'd wipe it when we get back, and it's always ready for use.
Oh, wow.
If you were to travel a lot to international locations, I might recommend having a cell phone or something like that that had bare minimum data on it that was just necessary for that work trip, and just, you know, using that, you know, buying a cheap beater phone and using that to physically segment, you know, what's going on. Again, this is like the tinfoil side of things. You know, I'm very much in favor of, you know, personal rights, the civil liberties, and the privacy and protection that's afforded to us by living in the United States. Occasionally, when you have an encounter with law enforcement, they aren't interested in those sort of same rights. And certainly when you cross the border, you know, that causes some issues as well. Some of my family members, they actually used to live within that 100-mile zone of the United States border, where the Border Patrol can basically do whatever they want. Now, we never had any issue with them. We never had the, you know, Border Patrol go through our things or whatever, but we knew a lot of people who had. And so, you know, it's possible to run into trouble, even if you're not going to a different country, even if you're just driving around, you know, the southern United States. You know, these things can and do happen on a regular basis. So, I don't know. I'll take my tinfoil hat off. In conclusion, mobile devices, they have a lot of advantages, right? A lot of them come out of the box encrypted. They have these walled gardens that are put in, the sandbox, the application to protect them from each other. Typically, they encourage some sort of security from form of passphrase, biometrics. This is all good stuff. I agree. It makes us all safer. There are some steps you should take, though. You should think about what's on your phone. You should think about how you use your phone. You should think about where you take your phone and some of the tools there. What I'd love to see phone makers do is I'd love for them to provide, you know, a means. Maybe there's a way to do this on Android. I don't know. But I'd love to see on iOS, for example, where I could type in a different passphrase and actually get a different user experience. And so that would provide some plausible deniability. And give us a means to compel with, like, lawful or unlawful orders from the Border Patrol and police, but actually maintain our privacy as well. I don't know if that's a feature that can be implemented, but it's something I would be a good step.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything to, you know, protect yourself in the end, whether or not you feel like in the wrong, you know, protect yourself.
It's a good thing. I don't know. Everything, like we always say, goes back to that trade-off, security versus privacy. These things may or may not fit you. You may want to even take a more hardline approach and have nothing on your phone. You know, some days I think about just going back to, like, a Nokia candy bar phone and telling people not to text me and just using it for phone calls.
If not only for that sweet, sweet battery life.
Yeah. I mean, that was great. I remember not having to charge my phone every day. That was glorious. Oof. So, I mean, you know, there's people who make that trade-off. I'm not willing to make that one, but I am willing to take some steps to protect myself in other ways. So, as always, your mileage may vary depending on, you know, your taste preferences and the tightness of the tinfoil. And, you know, we hope the show was a little bit helpful in finding that balance.
Yeah, and maybe just, like, one little part, you know, you could take away. Just one little piece you can go, okay, you know, maybe I'm not tinfoily, but, you know, at least I could maybe buy a USB condom, you know.
And right, so, okay, right.
You know, that makes sense. It's a simple $8, you know, protect myself. Yeah, just little things like that, you know. And eventually one day you'll buy yourself your own tinfoil, The finest made, and you will join our ranks.
Yeah, no. When you get your lizard, Zach, are you gonna wrap that in tinfoil too?
Oh, you bet I am.
You don't want the rays getting to that, you know. Otherwise, they'll turn them against you.
That's right. I mean, he needs his UVA A and UVA B, you know, so he can better absorb food. But other than that, dude, no, he's not getting any of their government control rays, so he can crawl up on top of me while I sleep and suck out my information.
Yeah. No, you gotta watch out for those lizards,
slimy like that, bastards. So.
All right, Zach, my voice is shot. I'm gonna go play with my new iPhone.
All right.
It's been a pleasure. Hopefully we don't get hacked in the meantime and no Border Patrol steals my phone. So.
Yep. Well, it also may just be me because I'm still at a 6S Plus and I covet you.
Yeah, no, it happens. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife nor his ass. So just know that.
Well, it doesn't say iPhone, so I'm taking it.
Yeah, no, okay, fair enough. All right, Zach. Another one in the can, bro.
Yep, another one. All right, you and everyone else that's listening, I hope you have yourselves a good night.
Yep, see you next week.
All right, see ya.